Hey guys, it's Brandon. A few quick announcements before the show. Number one, our good friend Emily Freedommaker, the intensivist via Kentucky, has actually been involved in founding a new postgrad APP critical care fellowship program at her current institution, which is Vandalia Health in Charleston, West Virginia. So a brand new program as of this year, and we wanted to let you know about it because you may be interested. This is not a paid deal with her or anything like that. We just love Emily. And while it's new, if she's involved, it's probably a safe bet that it's a good program. It's a generalist critical care program, 1 year. They accept PAs or NPs, which is always great to see. They rotate you through a bunch of different ICUs. It sounds like a solid program. So check it out if you're interested. It's their website says their apps are due on August 8th, and I think this is going up on the 6th, so that's kind of a tight turnaround. But I don't know how strict that deadline is. And the first class starts in October. So, you know, it is soon, but check it out if that is relevant to you. Second thing, the Vanderbilt APP Critical Care Bootcamp, which is a training program they do every year. It's 2 days. They just do kind of a general review of lots of critical care topics from a lot of real smart people, ranging from didactic stuff to hands-on stuff. It's a cool program. Is going on in September. It's the 3rd and the 4th in Nashville at Vanderbilt. I will be there speaking on a couple of topics, as will be a number of rather more intelligent and attractive people. But if you are looking for a conference, looking for some training, I think it's going to be awesome. A really cool kind of dedicated critical care program. Check that out too if you're interested. Finally, we are excited to report over at the Intensive Care Academy, Brian and my other project, we're hitting our 1 year anniversary. It's been a super exciting year of growth. Tons of awesome content on there. We're at 50 video lessons. Lots of podcasts, a lot of good community growth there. It's been awesome. And we wanted to celebrate the 1 year with a little sale. So if you're not yet a member, you could pop over to icu101.com. And when you join, use the code AUG, like August25, AUG25. That'll give you 20% off new subscriptions. We just really want to get you guys around because we're having a lot of fun over there. And hey, save some money in the meantime. AUG25, that'll be good for the entire month of August 2025. So if the month starts with August, it'll still work. Come September, not anymore. Check it out, guys. ICU101.com. On to the show. Hey, everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Brian Bowling, and with me, as always, is Brandon Odo.
Yellow.
We thought, if you haven't heard, there's a new certification out there for those of us who are advanced practice providers in critical care, and it comes from the American College of Chest Physicians, also known as CHEST. And we've been talking about this, and we thought, what's up with this? So we thought we'd do an episode about it, and we thought we should probably get somebody on who knows, you know, marginally more than we do about this test, and which is
everything we know about this, nothing. We just described. So, like,
yeah, we're pretty much at the episode would be over right now if it weren't for our guest.
There was an email that appeared announcing this. That's all I maybe there's some of you guys are better informed than me, but I think it's been kind of something that was like being built behind the scenes that's been revealed. So, we don't know much.
Yeah, so we figured we should probably rectify that. Otherwise, this would be a really short and, well, maybe entertaining, probably not a very informative episode. So we had Leah Sloan come and join us, and she's a PA who works up in Detroit at the Henry Ford Health System, where she's the manager of all the critical care APPs. And more importantly for today's discussion, she is the co-chair of the Critical Care APP Steering Committee for CHEST and helped develop this particular certification that we've been so well describing. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Leah, I mean, the obvious question to start with is what's the deal here? We can probably extrapolate to a very limited extent if you say that there is some sort of a new certification for APPs in critical care, but not much more. So what is this project? What was the aim of it? What does it look like?
Yeah, so this is multifold. Really, the purpose of the certification is to really provide a unified method for validating the knowledge and skills of APPs working in critical care in sort of a standardized fashion. I can explain more of kind of how we came about this.
Well, what was the genesis of it? I mean, did someone just wake up one day and say, you know what we need? Was there like some clamoring? Like, where did this start?
Yeah. And so I think there is a problem here. And I think that the problem is that APPs in critical care have grown tremendously, really the past decade. From where I began and probably you two have began, you know, there was very few of us practicing critical care medicine. And now that has just exploded. And I think that that explosion comes with it a myriad of problems. And some of the problems is A, getting people interested in critical care medicine, B, providing the adequate training required to do that role, and see how to keep people up to date on the latest and greatest in critical care medicine, as well as keeping ourselves in that critical care team-based environment in a way that contributes to best outcomes. So how this was born really is there enough support for critical care APPs? And I'll ask that to you too. Coming out of school, did you feel there was enough support for critical care APPs or those who are interested in working in that field?
So it's interesting. We just did an episode not long ago where we had where we discussed critical care APP fellowship programs. And I think this sort of goes to that same question, right? When you come out of school, are you ready? Are you prepared to take on this role? And I think that's one of the things that we talked about in that episode was that fellowship programs are sort of filling that gap for people who feel like they're not.
Yeah. Because otherwise the answer is totally dependent on whoever hires you. And like any non-standardized thing, that could mean, they're going to give you some great training, or it might mean something else. So
Yeah, totally. So again, and I think you guys just highlighted a multitude of problems that we're seeing is, yes, fellowships are a great idea, and I think that they are much needed for APPs coming out of school, but there are simply not enough of them, and their accessibility is really limited. And so how do you really keep up with that sort of education and training to meet the demand? The demand is overwhelming. The fellowships are how many? And how many do they allow? Very few. So it really has the need for qualified critical care APPs has really outpaced any sort of training program. And you're absolutely right that your training depends on your employer. And many times APPs are being hired with no formalized training or experience. They do not have mentors, and they're taken from school and expect to perform at a very high level, taking care of patients that they're most vulnerable. And is that the right thing? So this really came from CHEST, as you guys know. Their whole mission statement is about innovation, education to bring about best patient outcomes. And how do we achieve best patient outcomes? That's really in a team-based environment. We know there's simply not enough intensivists to go around for the need of critical care patients. And so really that's why APPs have been brought in that space, but we need to be brought in correctly and with enough support. So initially we were brought together. There was a group of APPs really from across the country that came together at CHEST to talk about some of the challenges we're having in that critical care space, ensuring that APPs are being well supported and are contributors to good patient outcomes in these critical care teams. And it was interesting. We had PAs, we had NPs, we had people working in SICUs and MICUs, CVICUs, all of the disciplines. And although we came from various parts of the country, we all shared very similar struggles. And you know, the first thing we did was sort of level set. Okay, there's the PA and NP issue, right? That everyone likes to talk about and argue about. And what we all decided is that at the end of the day, let's acknowledge our various training programs and backgrounds. But at the end of the day, we are all performing the same clinical functions. Okay. So we also agree that neither PA program, no acute or acute care nurse practitioner program adequately prepares you to practice in that high acuity environment from graduation. just doesn't. And so the fellowships were great, but again, not enough, accessibility low. And so oftentimes, what are we hiring into these spaces? And that's new graduates. And new graduates don't have that knowledge or experience, and we're relying on, in academic settings, it could be resident education. In fellowships, maybe it's more formalized, but in many other settings, it's learn as you go. Make mistakes, learn from your mistakes. Maybe you have a mentor, maybe you don't. And what you're seeing overwhelmingly is a lot of times for many new APPs are not well supported and they quit and you have turnover and you have cost issues. Or you've got providers that sort of give us a bad name. They're not doing the right things because they just don't know better. And now in the medical community, you know, one bad APP, we're all bad, right? And so it's really about setting a standard and benchmarking what a critical care APP should know. So a lot of this we talked about was education, 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 and how do we do that? And then how do we hold critical care APPs to a standard of practice that we would like to see, we see in ourselves, and how do we continue this on for the next generation? Because I think some of the things that we fear as APPs is that in many places we're turning into scribes, and that hurts my heart. So this is where this was really born out of, is how do we really as APPs come together, support this community in a way that's meaningful, in a way that affects patient outcomes. And so that was one piece of it. And then how do we evaluate what we're doing as the right thing? And this is where the certification came in. And it's really about creating a national standard and benchmark for the knowledge and application of that knowledge for APPs working in critical care.
I want to point out, you said something that I think is really interesting, because I can already hear people right now who are arguing, but et cetera. And I think you're right, right? The problem is not that there aren't people out there who are doing a great job. The problem is not that there aren't employers who are providing great onboarding. The problem is not that there aren't great programs who are providing great education. It's that there's a lack of a standard.
Correct.
Right? And I've always argued that your standard is the minimum acceptable, right? So if you say that, I argue this all the time with my colleagues, I'll say colleagues just in the broad sense, not necessarily the ones I work with, but in the APP, specifically the acute care and NP education world, if there's a school out there that's accepting people with no experience, then that's the standard, right? And we can say all we want to, well, we require that you have 2 years of ICU experience as a nurse to get in the program. Great, but not every place does. So the standard for an acute care NP is no experience. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with PAs, right? And so I was fortunate enough to, when I took my first job out of school, I got excellent onboarding. I got 6 months graduated responsibility, tests. I mean, I had to do oral exams with my faculty and stuff. It was phenomenal. But I also have friends who graduated, took a job, and they said, great, here you go. Here's your pager. Here's your list. Yeah. Good luck tonight. And so before people like kind of lose their mind over, you know, well, they're saying that I'm not good.
No.
I don't think that's what anybody's saying. I think we're saying that there's not a standard, and that's what this is addressing, right?
Absolutely. The issue is consistency, right? Yeah. There is no consistent way to onboard and train that is everybody is using. And so that's really what our ultimate goal is, that we want critical care APPs to perform at a certain level, okay, so that all patients get excellent care independent of their setting or the practitioner, right? It should be consistent. And like residency programs, there is a standard there that they have to meet to say that, yes, I am an intensivist, I'm a cardiologist, I'm a pulmonologist. There's a standard, a minimum, as you say, requirements needed in order to call yourself that. And I think this is where we're at. And you're right. I think there are fabulous programs out there. But I also think, you know, in the community type setting where we also are seeing a lot of APPs, they don't have that type of support. They also have such a tremendous need. They can't afford to onboard someone for 6 months to a year, like many of these well-developed, especially coming from an academic setting, that though they have. They just don't have that luxury. It's more plug and play.
I have questions, but let's finish setting the table before we make our meal. What So what is this? I mean, I'll get you started. I assume there's a test you go and take. Tell us more.
Yeah, so it's an exam. It's 150 questions. You get 5 hours to take it, and it's pretty comprehensive. It's going to cover all of your body systems that you would see in critical care. So, you know, down cardiology, pulmonology, gastroenterology, there is some ultrasound interpretation. There's a lot of application of knowledge and not just regurgitation. When we came together, this was all, by the way, created by APPs for APPs. And so the content is very much what an APP is going to take care of in their daily role. And so when we went through all the areas that we felt as a group needed to be addressed, what questions needed to be had, it actually mirrored very closely, especially in percentages, that of the board certification for critical care. But this has an APP focus. We may not be showing pathology slides of certain things, but we are definitely going to be talking about bedside hemodynamic management.
Okay. So it is 150 questions.
Yep.
Wholly multiple choice. I assume a computerized exam. You go to one of those centers or something like that.
So 150 questions. It can be taken at home. There are windows for which you can take it. I think the first window is... I'd have to look. I think it's August 19th to September 30th, so you will have a window.
That was my other question. So it's not just any time, but it's not just once a year or something like
Correct.
That. There's more.
Yeah, this year it's being offered once, and then it will be offered twice a year after that. It's multiple choice. It covers all of your body systems, but it also has a lot of ultrasound interpretation, procedural type questions, complication of procedures. Has some ethical questions in there. There are domains that are found on the website that you can look over. There is also a blueprint that you can use to help prepare yourself.
Okay. Yeah. And people should probably refer to that for more details. But in general, it's the content domain of critical care here is meant to be generalist, meaning it should be applicable in any ICU setting?
Yes.
Okay. So if you're going to go and work in a medical ICU or a surgical ICU or a neuro ICU, there may be specialty knowledge for those areas that is not covered here, because you don't expect everyone to know the obscure neuro stuff, but the stuff here is applicable there. Is that
yes. What I would say is that it is weighted. And so you're going to have most heavily weighted areas are going to be pulmonary and cardiovascular, because that's applicable to all disciplines. But you are going to have your smattering of neuro ICU questions with head bleeds, blood pressure management, and goals. You're going to have your smattering of trauma and OB and SICU. However, those are less weighted, 1% to 3%.
Is there a passing score, or is it a kind of nebulous, complicated moving target that...
Yeah, good question.
Percentile-based kind of thing.
So this is the first time it's being offered, and we have been working with Prometric on this. And so with the first exam, it's going to be reviewed by the board, basically what questions were good questions, which ones need to be thrown out. And then from there, we'll sort of see what answers we get and then set a passing score for that. So this is our first go round. And so it still needs to have some evaluations on how well the questions were written and such. But Prometric is really leading this march.
I assume you pay something for the privilege of taking this. What's the damage?
I think it's $450.
Future editing Brandon here. The actual cost is $325 to register for the exam plus $25 to apply. And you take it, you pass. I assume you hear, I mean, maybe longer, but a month later or something like that, you'll get an email saying you passed.
Right.
And then what? You get a certificate saying that you are...
Yeah, you'll get a certificate. You'll get the designation of CCAPP to put into your word salad after your names. And then this is valid for 3 years. And you don't have to retake the test necessarily, but you do have to submit that you have 45 hours of CME over that 3 years in one of the specific domains of critical care.
Not necessarily separate from the CME you have accumulated to maintain your other licenses, but it has to be specifically... in the domain of critical care.
Correct.
Yep. That. All right. Well, that kind of gives us the general sense here, I suppose. I feel like the obvious question, because we kind of laid out that there's potentially an issue of training, or at least of standardization of training. What you've created here is not training. It's a standardized domain of knowledge and a way to assess it, right?
Yep.
So I assume that the goal is that that translates or becomes a stepping stone to standardized training. But I'm also not sure what that step would look like. What do you hope people will do with this? Now, if someone are out there is seems feel like they're well-trained, they're like, why don't I get more certification? They go and take the test. Okay, fine. But that doesn't really change much for them except make it easy to prove their knowledge. If the goal is to promote the training of people who are not yet or maybe are undertrained, what would that look like?
Good question. I do think the goal of the certification is to really highlight critical care APPs and validate their knowledge and experience, not just to ourselves, but to the whole medical community. This is really for career advancement. So that is really the goal of the certification, is really bringing to light the contributions that APPs make in this critical care space. As far as education goes, agreed. This is a difficult piece to really standardize. And in that vein, we have created tools to help prepare for the test. And so one of them is the essentials of critical care concepts for APPs. That's also found on the CHEST website. It's 23 hours of lectures that were created for APPs, both new and established. Those have been working in it. It is all evidence-based and up to date. And so half of the lectures are lectures that were done for APPs by APPs, and they break things down from to the fundamental level. And what I mean by that is many times, especially community hospitals, I came from a community hospital initially, and APPs were just sort of, welcome to the ICU, let me show you around the unit, here are some nurses, and here's your patients. And so a lot of times they would look for boot camps, or they would go to a CHEST or an SCCM conference, and the lectures they're listening to are pretty high level for where they're at. So they're going to talk about the latest and greatest advancements of ARDS, but they don't really have a background on the basics of ARDS, or let's go through ventilator troubleshooting, but I don't know what a normal settings are. And so some of the lectures are definitely APP focused of like, here is a ventilator, here are the different modes, this is how you titrate, this is the mechanics behind a ventilator and why this makes sense. And now let's build on that. Now we can talk about waveforms. Now we can talk about troubleshooting. And so when they go to these conferences, they have that foundation set that we often don't get. It's a lot of pathophysiology, you know, especially when it comes to shock. We're going to talk about all the latest and greatest management of shock, but if you don't understand shock at its fundamentals, how do you grow from there? And so it's less knee-jerk medicine and more understanding the principles behind and the pathophysiology behind disease processes so that you are able to grow and build on that foundation. That's about half of the lectures, again, done by APPs for APPs, meeting APPs where they're at because we've all been there. The other half is really the topics that are growing your practice as an established APP. It is talking about the latest and greatest developments when we talk about hemolytic uremic syndrome. How do we recognize it? What is the treatment for it? What is the latest evidence-based practice on ARDS? What are we doing now? So it is comprehensive, and it gives a starting block for many APPs. When I used to train them, they would come to me and say, what resources can I use? And I would give them the usual books that I think we're all familiar with, and it kind of gives them a generalized idea. But it's hard for them to read books and sort of apply it in practice. As opposed to listening to a lecture, I can assign the lecture and say, hey, listen to this lecture. When you come in next shift, we're going to talk about it. And your next patient that's going to be assigned is going to be one who's on mechanical ventilation. And we're going to sort of build upon this basic lecture that you've already heard. So the education is there. It is in partner with this if it's wanted. We also realize that there are fabulous programs out there that already have education built in and don't need this.
And that program is Essentials of Critical Care.
Yep, it's called the Essentials of Critical Care Concepts for APPs, and it's on the CHEST website.
And was that developed in conjunction with the certification, or that was something that existed already?
So in conjunction. So we all agreed that there was a need for education in a platform, basically, right, that's sort of bundled directly for APPs. And so this, we bundled this, again, 23 lectures, half of them done by us. The other half is sourced from the board review series for physicians, with the intent, because the certification rolled out quite quickly, with the intent that all of those lectures will eventually be done all by APPs.
I'm trying to think of analogies to things that exist. I mean, the ones that jump out are, of course, the nurses have a critical care certification that is used by some of them to, you know, demonstrate a standard level of knowledge, like you said. There's FCCS, Fundamental Critical Care Support, the SCCM does, which is a standard certification course. I guess, you know, Brian, the ways I could imagine people using something like this are either you say, we'll maybe provide financial support or something if any of our staff take this, and maybe you'll, it's like they do for the bedside nurses a lot of places, we'll give you a bonus or something, you know, we'll give you some incentive. We'd like you to have it, but it's not required. Or you say, we want all our team to have standard training. Every new hire, we're gonna put you through maybe the education program. You're gonna take the test, and then you'll all be certified. Something like that. That would be, I guess, a bigger lift in terms of you got to spend some money and kind of mandate training and that sort of thing. But then you end up with a team that is all coming from the same place.
Well, I know I've had conversations before with some of my physician friends, and several of them have said, you know, sort of, you know, in my opinion, certification programs are not really great. They're not. It's just you're paying money to take a test to get a piece of paper. And I think to some degree there's truth in that. But I think the distinction that has to be made is between physicians and APPs, right? If you're a physician who undergoes a critical care fellowship, yeah, you don't necessarily need a special certification. This comes up when we talk about ultrasound certification a lot, right? You don't need POCUS certification because it's assumed
that you know it,
that you have that, because that's part of the standardized education of a physician in critical care. But like Leah said, for APPs, that standardization doesn't exist. So I tell my students all the time, like, if you're interested in learning POCUS, then you should prepare for that as if you're going to get certified. Whether you do or not is up to you, but you might as well. And then you have something that says, I know what I'm doing, besides just your word. And same thing for this, right? If you, you know, go to California and decide I want to live there and get a job, and somebody goes, well, how do I know that you know what you're doing? You go, well, I have this certification from an established body that rigorously applies. And you go, oh, okay, well, you do, right?
And that's the thing, right? Because there's such a wide range of people who do our job. And if someone knows you, then that they know where you are on that spectrum. But this problem can be as simple as you go to a new job, that your job hires somebody else who doesn't yet know you. I mean, any of those things. Otherwise, your whole relationship is built on just how well you know each other. It's like, you know, it's like you need a plumber or something. You'd like to just know a guy that you know is good. If you don't, you just blind, you got to go and like Google him or something. And what you'd love to have is some kind of stamp saying, this person knows what they're doing, they're ethical, they are not going to blow up your house, things like that. And that may or may not be available. In a role like ours, same sort of deal. Beyond that minimum, you know, floor, you're still kind of dealing with all sorts of things, but you know you have some kind of standardization. And that, I mean, there is still plenty of room to be your own person and to sub-specialize in certain things or whatever. But I think people sometimes oversell the value of that versus standardization. The people who solely drive their own training or are the product of their own environment end up really good at a few things, bad at other things, with big knowledge gaps that they don't even appreciate because they've never been forced to go and learn something standardized. And then they realize, oh, there's like, this is the way to think about this. I didn't even realize there was this whole consideration and so on and so forth. No one learns stuff in such a comprehensive way unless you make them. That's the role of standards.
Right. And I was going to say, I'll give you another example. When I was in school, I had a brief period where I flirted with the idea of doing first assist in the operating room. And, you know, as a nurse practitioner, at least at the time, so no angry emails if this is wrong now, at the time, as an acute care nurse practitioner, you didn't have to have any sort of special training or certification to be a first assist. I mean, obviously, I didn't know what you were doing, but you didn't have to have any formal training or any kind of licensed or specialty certification. And there was a cardiac surgeon that I knew who said, I mean, I'll hire you and you can just, I'll teach you how to first assist mm-hmm. and it'd be fine. You don't need to do a first assist program. And I was like, sweet, this is great, right? Mm-hmm. It saves me some money, saves me some time. I don't have to learn all that crap I don't care about. And a professor told me, don't do that. Because what you're going to learn is you're going to learn only how to do cardiac surgery. And you're only going to learn how to do cardiac surgery the way he does cardiac surgery. So what happens when you, yeah, you go to get a new job, he retires, dies, whatever happens, and you have to go get a new job, how do you prove that you know what you're doing? You can't. You just say, well, yeah, I've done this before, right? Like your example, Brandon. I mean, I could say, well, I'm a plumber because I've fixed a water heater in my house and I fix our leaky toilet all the time. But if somebody hires me to do, you know, some, I don't even know enough about plumbing to tell you what I can't do, right? I'm going to go, well, I don't know that. I mean,
you know, Brian, I think you bring up a really good point about physician training and taking you under their wing. 20 years ago when I started, it's private groups and private physicians, it was in their best interest to train you, right? From scratch to the way they practice and bring you under their wing and to train you well, because then it ease the burden off them, right? And they could trust you and you develop that relationship. Well, the landscape is changing so much in medicine that a lot of APPs are now being hired by hospitals. And you work with physicians, but not necessarily under them. And they really have no skin in the game as you're training, because the hospital can fire you or hire you at will. And some places don't have a choice. Those physicians don't have a choice in who they hire. And so I see less and less of physicians mentoring and losing that connection. Not always, but that connection sometimes is not always there the way it used to be. And so to your point, this would be a standardized way to evaluate and ensure they at least meet a minimum capability or of practice. And again, to your point about being able to move states, you know, it's very hard for APPs, especially in these specialized fields, to move, because it's, you know, that you're sacrificing the relationship that you have with your current group, right? And we value that very much. And now you're going to have to start all over again somewhere else, establish your credibility and your relationship, where physicians can just say, I'm board certified. You know, I'm a board certified pulmonologist and I'm going to move over here, and everyone accepts that. Well, he's a board certified pulmonologist. He should know what he's doing. You know, he met a minimum requirement. So, right. And again, by CHEST bringing this forward, it's not a PA organization bringing this forward, because I don't think anyone would pay attention. And it's also not a nurse practitioner organization bringing this forward, because again, I don't think anyone pays attention but our respective groups. This is a traditionally right. physician-led organization that is well-established. They have the credibility and they're a leader in evidence-based critical care medicine. And so it's almost like a neutral party that's already trusted and respected, that's giving us this platform and bringing us to the level that we deserve as part of the critical care team.
And, you know, I think there are other downsides to that model of training that are not always obvious. You know, it is a very traditional way of learning. You kind of learn alongside a master and they teach you everything they know. And it really does have its upsides. But what do you end up learning? You end up learning what they know, or actually just what they want to teach you, which can be very specific. Maybe you, let's say the surgeon example, maybe you work with a surgeon who just does like foot surgery all day. That's all you're going to learn. And in fact, all you're going to learn is their way of doing things, which makes you very well equipped to work with them. But that is not, I mean, even if you're going to say, well, I'm going to be the master of working with foot surgery patients, it's actually what you're doing is what works well in your system there, which may not necessarily be like deep foundational knowledge. It may be driven by what's most convenient for the surgeon, like what helps them get through their day, what helps them, I don't know, bill. I mean, practical stuff like that. Everyone's biases are, I mean, they're always real, and they're not necessarily fed by the sorts of things that develop your training in a deep general level. Part of the benefit of truly intentional generalist training, like, you know, going to college and getting a bachelor's degree in something, is that it forces you to learn things just for general knowledge sake that you are not necessarily for a reason and therefore not subject to biases. You know, should you give a certain drug in a certain situation? In a purely educational setting, the answer is purely based on data and things like that. In a practical everyday situation, it may be based on other things, like how much does that drug cost, or you know, things like that.
Sure. Yeah.
And then you also learn how to practice in a way that's very localized. So the person who's worked for 20 years with one surgeon in one center, they may not have any idea how to work with not just other surgeons or other groups, but in other hospitals or other regions, never mind other countries, that's a whole nother matter. Because you've only learned certain things. You see certain diseases, you see certain procedures, you see certain ways of doing things. And again, that's the reason why it can be very powerful to start from a general background and then narrow down. You go work at a certain place and you say, well, we do certain things here. Okay, but your toolkit is bigger than that. And your knowledge base goes back to more first principles and less to just, well, we do the, you know, things this way here, either I don't know why or because Dr. So-and-so likes it or something right. like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've talked before about the idea of lifelong learning and sort of self-directed teaching and, you know, lots of all the resources that are out there and stuff. And I always say one of the big pitfalls of doing your own learning is the lack of curriculum. Right. Because you're going to focus on, like you said, the things that interest you, the things that you see, the things that you want to focus on. Right. If you just said back in the day when Twitter was still a thing, if you just said, I'm just going to study everything that pops up on Twitter, you would be the master of ECMO and POCUS. But you probably wouldn't know anything about a lot of the bread and butter stuff that we do in the ICU every day because it's just not cool. And we don't talk about
it. Not interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. But like when you say, you know, and like you were talking about the regional variations, right? Going back to the foot example, right? Not only are you only going to learn foot surgery, but you're only going to learn the foot surgeries that you see. Right? What if you don't see any of these cases very often? Or what if your surgeon wants to do all of those because he likes them? So he allocates the ones to you that he doesn't like, right? So you're getting an incomplete education versus if you go to, you know, and again, not to keep comparing ourselves to physicians, but if you go to a physician residency program or a fellowship program, there's certain requirements. You have to do this many cases of this many patients of this, et cetera. And, you know, maybe you're in a residency program where you just happen to see a bunch of that, but maybe you don't, and you're just going to barely meet the minimum requirements, but there's something there to make sure that you're exposed to it. And I think that's the danger of the non-standardized, whether it's you doing it or whether it's you say, well, I've got a physician that's going to teach me this, or my boss says I need to learn this or whatever. Just sort of a non-standard curriculum is that you're going to potentially miss out on the stuff that's either harder for you to get to do because you don't see as much, or there's some advantage to having someone else do it. Like I said, the physician really likes to do that particular surgery. He does it all himself, et cetera.
Well, or, I mean, not to beat this dead horse, but the other downside of experiential training is that it's weighted towards frequency. So you'll get really good at the things you do every day, like writing post-op notes or whatever. But a lot of the really important things to know are rare. The rare complication, emergency, niche case, something like that. And in a non-structured setting for learning, you only encounter those when they come up, which by definition is very rarely or perhaps never. Mm-hmm. And then when that person comes along who has the air embolism or something like that, you don't know anything about it. It's not on your radar because it was not something you happened to pick up. And then, you know, it sucks to be that person, basically. Whereas, you know, it's almost more beneficial to learn about those things that are uncommon because then you actually know what to do versus you can't help but learn how to write a post-op note or whatever. But
right.
The other thing I want to ask you, Leah, was what do you envision, I mean, if you had your druthers in a few years, this program has had uptake, would you love to see this being near universal, like it was almost everyone who was doing this? Or do you think it's appropriate and reasonable for it to be used kind of sporadically for specific things? Could it become a new standard for people in this role, or should it? I mean, that's always the flip side of adding in something like a certification. Maybe it becomes a standard when we didn't want it to be.
I personally would like to see it as a standard. And I don't want to say should, because I think that that's a strong word and that's going to have a lot of opinions, but I practicing at a minimal standard is what's going to drive, I think, best outcomes. If you meet the standard, and then those who go above and beyond and continue to grow and learn, maybe in those areas, like you said, that they're interested in, is only going to make them the better. But not having any standard, surely I don't think is good for patient care, especially with the level of responsibility many APPs have in these critical care units. I really also think for those that are experienced in critical care, I think you finally have a certification that will validate your knowledge and experience. But also, I think that this is really going to acknowledge the groundwork that those of us who have been in critical care medicine and have been doing this for a long time, and also pave the way for new APPs in critical care by setting that standard. Again, the thing that I fear is that we have untrained or APPs who don't have a minimal standard are not practicing at the highest level, and physicians don't know any better, and so we just allow them to write notes and thinks that is the standard. That is my biggest fear. And so for those of us who have been in critical care for a long period of time, have made those relationships, have the autonomy, have the knowledge, how do we keep that going for the next generation, especially with the numbers that these NP/MPA schools are turning out?
Do you imagine a future where this is the generalist foundation of critical care knowledge, but then you develop similar products that are specialty specific, like the neurocritical care certification?
Yeah, good question. I don't know if I've thought that far ahead yet. I do know that we're actually the second certification to my knowledge for this type of specialty certification. Cardiology has already come out with one for APPs. I don't know if you're aware of. So we would sort of be the second, but I do think that specialty specific certifications are going to become more the norm. Much like NPs sort of specialized in their areas. I think the way things are going now, APPs are continually, even now, 5 years ago, I would say, you know, no, I'm not going to get a PhD, a D, and, you know, whatever the advanced degree is. And now you see everybody getting their MBAs or getting their Doctor of Medical Science. And some of this is merit badge medicine, yes. But some of this, and I think in this realm of specialty work, is important and is going to advance the profession.
Yeah, I mean, the for PAs, the AAPA has had I forget what they call it, but it's a specialty certification
CAQs.
Program. Yeah, for certain specialties. There was never one for critical care, but there was for emergency medicine and some other things. So I guess you could argue that's in the same realm, but
no.
Of course, that's only for PAs.
Yeah, I disagree. Like, and I'll probably have the AAPA hate me for this, but I think the CAQs, they are certification of added qualifications. They mean nothing but to PAs, right? And even then, physicians don't know to look for this because they're not aware of it. And I don't know how validated they are. And I may have the AAPA come after me, and I apologize for that. But this is why I really think that it's important that CHESS brings this about, that this is sort of a neutral party, and this is a well-known party that's a leader in evidence-based practice, and that's really where we want our APPs to be at.
Yeah, and that's what, of course, we're always prefer our own biases here, and mine are usually, you know, focusing training towards, you know, the specialty and the medicine rather than the people doing it. So I love that you made this for, quote, APPs, not for PAs or MPs, because who cares which one you are? And of course, if it originates with one of those groups, it's going to be specific to that group, as it is mm-hmm. for the CAQs. And that it originated from a critical care organization like CHEST, and again, not from some group that was about a certain people's. Now, of course, this is targeted for certain groups, but it's about critical care, because critically ill people don't care who you are, right, whether you're a doctor or you have one of these roles or whatever. Now, of course, again, you do have to target it towards a certain group. It's going to be a different certification for an RN compared to a physician or for one of us. But it's about the medicine. So I feel like that kind of starts us on the right foot about priorities rather than about creating more divisions that don't need to be there or just kind of making it about the process. It's about the content. At least that's the impression I get so far.
No, yeah, absolutely. It's about the content and it's really about elevating APPs in this role. But, I think what Trust is doing, and of course, I don't work for them, but I will say that they are really creating a movement in supporting team-based care. So they are promoting physicians and APPs collaborating instead of competing. And they are uniting PAs and NPs as equal professionals. And they are promoting an interdisciplinary team and setting egos aside and saying, we know together we are better. And together we are better for our patients. And I don't think I've seen that from a traditionally physician-led organization. And furthermore, they are opening their doors to having other non-physician leaders in their organization. So again, promoting that team-based care and really keeping the patient at its center, not worrying what your title is, not worrying what your level of training is, but coming together, all practicing high-quality medicine.
Well, and I think that's important. You sort of alluded to this with it, and the AAPA can get mad at me. I don't care. I don't want to intentionally piss them off, but they don't have any control over me. But you could very easily say, if the AAPA came out and said, here's a CAQ for critical care that shows PAs are qualified to do critical care. And, before the nurses get whatever, insert nursing organization here, right? NPs are qualified to do critical care. I think there's a temptation then for people to go, well, of course you're going to say that, right? You're a PA organization. Of course you're going to say the PAs know what they're doing. And of course you're going to say the NPs know what they're doing because you're an NP organization versus CHEST being a somewhat neutral arbiter, that people will look at. And I mean, are there going to be people who say APPs are not qualified? Sure, there always will be, right? But I think you're right. I think a lot more, it's going to be hard for people who are not APPs to argue with, an organization that 5 minutes ago I agreed with everything they said, and then they came out and said this, and I go, well, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and content that was developed, in collaboration with a multidisciplinary team. And as you said, if any group is biased towards its constituency, you could say that, CHEST is biased towards critical care. I mean, that's what it wants to support. Yeah. Of course, it's biased towards the people who make up the group. And of course, they make money on it. There is always that consideration. But sure. In general, I feel like that's where you want to go. And I mean, I like to hear you saying that it's the organization is moving that way. I think Brian and I have been most heavily involved in the past with SCCM. And I think part of the reason is that it always felt like a group that was very consciously multidisciplinary. And CHEST always kind of had the appearance of being a group oriented towards physicians. And other people can be members, but that was sort of who it was for. And that's why I was almost a little surprised to see this coming out of CHEST, because it's something I could have imagined more from SCCM. I mean, no shade at anyone here. Everyone has their own thing. But it is nice to see.
Yeah, I definitely think they're going through an evolution right now. I think they have definitely recognized the contributions that we make. They created this certification. They invested heavily into this, into us. I will say one of the most rewarding things is that first meeting, because I'll be honest with you, I had the same feeling about CHEST prior to being involved with them. And going to that first meeting, having NPs and PAs from all across the U.S. was interesting in and of itself once you get to start talking about different practices. But then having physicians sitting in the room and they were genuinely interested in us. What do you know? What are your backgrounds? Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, I didn't realize there were different models. Oh, I didn't realize you could do this. Oh, you can do that? Oh, well, of course my APPs do this. There were some physicians who in the room who use them every day and said, my APPs are awesome. This is what I have them do. But they were genuinely interested in our differences, our similarities, our roles, how we practiced across the nation. And to have physicians sit down and take the time to understand us felt so welcoming, something that I had honestly never experienced before in my own personal practice.
Maybe this is not a good analogy, but it comes to mind for some reason. It's like if you're trying to make a building accessible to people with disabilities, so much of what is a barrier to certain people is totally invisible unless you ask a question or have a conversation. And people say, well, you know, if you put that button there, I can't reach it from a wheelchair. And then a lot of it was just that's how it was. It never occurred to you that it could be a problem. It was just how you always did it and so on. There's no, you weren't married to that idea. It's just how it was. And so a lot of it, there's no like, it's not hostility or anything between disciplines. It's just you hadn't had that conversation yet. You did things a certain way. I mean, I suppose it takes some effort to change, but often it's not that much. You just have to try.
Yeah. They were just asking the right questions and, again, being truly interested in us, which I have fabulous relationships with my physicians, but I don't know if they're necessarily interested in my training where I came from. Not really. You know, at the end of the day, they want to just sort of get the job done and they want you to be good at your job. So it felt very welcoming, and every experience I've had since then has just honestly been so rewarding. Just the level of support that they have shown us, invested in us. You know, in addition to the education and the certification, they have seat questions, what they traditionally had for residents. Now they have them just for APPs in this exam. They have a MedCast. They're highlighting us at their annual conference. They had a lunch. You know, I could go on. And I would have said 3 years ago, I felt the exact same way you felt. Oh, that's for physicians. And it's really exciting, I think, for APPs that they really want to elevate us in this role, and that they're being so inclusive and want to hear from us, are interested in us, and are interested in our education, and really, how can we contribute to patient care?
All right. Well, this has been a great look at this. What else do you want to say about this? Anything you want to leave people with?
I think together it's going to take us experienced folks in critical care to really continue to move this forward. I think that we should really think about what the future looks like, especially not just for critical care APPs, but for APPs in general, and what kind of roles do we hope that we will be filling, and what kind of autonomy and level do we want to practice at? And think about that for the future. Promote this, because I think this will set the standard for the future of what a critical care APP looks like.
And if people want to take the test, I mean, should they just Google CHESS critical care APP certification and it'll take them to a place where they can sign up?
Yeah, so there is eligibility requirements. You do have to be a board certified physician assistant or associate, or acute care nurse practitioner, or the acute gerontology acute care certified nurse practitioner. Unfortunately, not offered to the other disciplines besides acute care. You have to have 2,000 hours of clinical practice in critical care medicine outside of your graduate program. And then you have to have a letter from your supervisor or medical director stating that you have that clinical bedside experience.
Now, 2,000 hours is about a year full time.
Right, exactly.
So that people should have started a job, maybe gotten their onboarding and things. And this is not like you walk into a job with this already. That would be unfeasible. Okay. And then the window for testing is, what are the dates?
August 19th through September 30th.
And then next time will be early next year?
Yeah, I don't know if they have the dates. Let me look. I don't think they have the dates for
those listening out asynchronously. We're in 2025, by the way. So, all right. Brian, anything else?
No, I don't think so. Oh, just to clarify, when you say outside of your graduate training, you mean school, right? You don't mean like a residency.
Right. It can include...
If you have a fellowship program or whatever.
Yes, it can include fellowship and residency programs. Absolutely. We just... This is not exam geared to someone who is fresh out of school.
Gotcha.
When we hand out the certification, we want to say, yes, you've actually been practicing it for a period of time before you take it, and you may want to prepare.
And I could see some post-grad programs maybe having their learners do this maybe towards the end of their program, something like that. All right. Well, thanks for joining us. We'll just remind everyone, this is just some general educational stuff. None of us really represent our institutions here, and that includes Leah, who is representing kind of the committee that helped develop this, but is certainly not speaking on behalf of CHESS, the larger organization here. You guys pop it into Google if you're interested. It's definitely an interesting idea. I hope to see it grow, and we'll talk to you next time.